Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the UK Money Podcast. My name is Jason Mountford. I'm an ex-financial advisor, and on this show, my aim, my goal is to help you use money as a tool to live the life you want to live. And today in the show, I want to talk about a couple of different things. I want to talk about the British ISA that's been announced a little while back. I know it's not sort of hot off the press, but I wanted to give my take on the British ISA and kind of a bit more of a broader take on investing in the UK in general, because I think it's something that a lot of us don't think too much about. We tend to focus our portfolio in the US, which is not a bad thing to do. It's something that I actually recommend a lot of the time, but I think is a case to be looking a little bit more closely at the UK market as well. So I want to talk about that. And then I want to talk about 99% mortgages. That's the another sort of hot topic that's been going around lately. We've seen them just be launched on the market. And I want to go over my thoughts on how that works. Now, I'm just double checking that the mic is on. Last week I recorded about 20 minutes of the episode and then realized that I had not turned my mic on, which is a real rookie error and shows that I'm not quite on my top form after the hiatus just yet, but we'll get there. So that is the plan for the show today. If you have any questions that you'd like answered on the show, please do feel free to reach out to me. Best way to do that is just to drop me an email at jason@jasonmountford.com. So as I said, the first thing I want to talk about today is the British ISA. This was announced in the spring budget a little while back, and it's already been said that the actual implementation of this has been postponed until after the general election. Now, because this is a Conservative policy, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. In fact, it may actually not happen. It'll be interesting to see whether Labor decide to carry on with that policy, because I actually think it's a really, really good one. And it's worth talking about anyway, because you know this is obviously an incentive to invest in the UK stock market. And I think, you know, I know we all have the capability to be able to do that if we want to anyway, in our regular SIPs and in our own ISAs and that sort of thing. We don't need a special ISA to do that, but this would just be sort of an added incentive. So kind of regardless of, let's quickly just talk about what it is. So if you missed this is a proposal where you would be able to retain and keep your existing £20,000 a year ISA allowance. That'd be unchanged. But you'd have an additional £5,000 allowance that would be used for investing in UK stocks. The idea behind that is that it would incentivize some you know, more investment into UK companies. You know, at the moment, the US stock market makes up around 70% of the global stock market. So it is massively overweight in terms of its representation from a market capitalization standpoint, that the size of the value of those companies. And like for good reason, right? You know, the US economy is the largest in the world. The second largest is China, which is a difficult market for foreign investors to access anyway. So, you know, it makes sense. The biggest companies in the world, generally speaking, are invested in the US. You can get a lot of diversification in the US. But I was listening to a podcast, and I've recommended this in some of the articles that I've been writing as well. It's called Maren Talks Money. She's a journalist from Bloomberg UK, and she talks about a wide range of different UK topics, actually. Sometimes she talks about the housing market. Sometimes she talks about stock market. So I definitely recommend that podcast if you're looking for something else to listen to. But anyway, I was listening to an episode a week or so back, and it was talking about the fact that the way we invest in the UK is very heavily into the US market, for obvious reasons, as I've just talked about. But one of the interesting things, points that her and her guest, his name escapes me, Charles Peel, I think it was talking about, was the fact that because of the tax benefits we get tax relief on our contribution into our SIPs and into our pensions, and we get obviously the tax benefits of a regular ISA and, you know, the additional contribution bonus on a lifetime ISA. There's a lot of tax breaks for investing in these wrappers, which is the whole point of them. But then because the majority or a large proportion of those investments are then made in US companies, in a way, it's like the UK taxpayer subsidizing the growth of US companies. Now, I'm going to get into a little bit later how a company stock price impacts the actual company itself. But I think first it's just worth kind of sitting on that point and kind of trying to understand how our investment choices impact kind of the economy as a whole. They were making some really interesting points about the fact that, you know, there is created this environment where the UK market has become pretty unattractive for regular investors. You know, most people that I speak to don't really have any sort of desire or, you know, real keenness to invest in companies like, AstraZeneca or HSBC or, you know, Lloyds, any of these kind of big, Tesco, Marks and Spencer. Like, we don't tend to have like the big sexy companies like you get on the US market, like Tesla, like Apple, like, you know, Google, whoever. And so there's this sort of, there's this flow of money that goes from the UK and from all, you know, various other different countries into the US market. And that helps the US market, has helped the US market become, you know, the biggest in the world. You know, there's obviously a huge amount of actual value that's being driven out of there. But there's also this aspect to share prices in the stock market that is detached from the underlying fundamentals. And the best example that I can think of is Tesla. You know, as an actual, from a financial standpoint, it is bonkers to me that Tesla is more valuable than Volkswagen, for example. When you think of, you know, the Volkswagen Group, Audi, Porsche, I think there's a couple of luxury marquees in there, like maybe Bentley. Don't quote me on this, but you know what I'm talking about. The Volkswagen Group covers, Seat, a huge range of individual brands of car, and yet Tesla is more valuable than them, more valuable than General Motors, more valuable than, I think at times, it's been more valuable than all those other car providers combined. And a huge proportion of that has been this capital flow. It's this money flowing to the sexy assets in the US. And there's a reason why I think this is something that we kind of all need to have a little bit of a think about when we're thinking about where we actually allocate our investment funds. So let's talk about why that matters. So why does it matter to a company if the stock price goes up a lot? So sticking on the Tesla example, because it's an easy one. Tesla stock price goes up, you know, a ridiculous amount because Elon Musk is tweeting stupid stuff. You know, the shine's definitely come off that guy. But, you know, going back a couple of years, you know, a tweet for him was more likely to boost the stock price than smash it, as it has been lately. But why does that matter? It makes him a lot richer. So obviously for the existing shareholders, that's great. But why does it matter to the fundamental running of a company if the stock price goes up, right? Because if a stock price doubles, that doesn't double the amount of cash that company has in the bank. It doesn't necessarily mean that their sales have doubled. So from a day-to-day running of a company, why does it really matter? And there's a few different reasons for that. So number one, it gives them a lot more flexibility in the way that they grow the business through things like acquisitions or through the way they finance growth. So for example, you know, if you have a company that has had a massive increase in its share value, it can use its stock price as compensation for takeovers. So if you had a company that was worth, you know, I don't know, $100 billion, £100 billion, and they, maybe didn't have a ton of cash on the balance sheet or didn't want to spend a ton of cash to acquire a competitor or acquire another business that could be in addition to their core existing business. You know, having a strong and rising stock price means using that stock as a way to fund those acquisitions is attractive for the other side. You know, if you're Tesco, and you want to buy Johnny's Corner Store, and Tesco's share price is on the rise, then Johnny is more likely to accept stock instead of cash for that deal. You know, they might want to buy him out for £10 million. If Johnny thinks that he could get £10 million worth of Tesla of Tesco stock, and then in a year that might be worth £11 million or £12 million, then he's going to be potentially pretty keen to do that deal. On the other hand, if the stock price is kind of stagnant, or maybe there's some risks on the horizon, and he's thinking, well, yeah, I could do a £10 million stock deal now, but by the time I'm allowed to sell that stock in 2 or 3 years or whenever the lockup period is, you know, maybe it's only worth eight. So actually, is that a good deal for me? I think I'm going to hang on for some cash, please. So that's number one. As a stock price grows, it gives them more flexibility in terms of, you know, acquisition targets. It also gives them a lot more flexibility in terms of traditional financing. So, you know, it's not a like exact example, but imagine it like your home, you know, a property. You know, if you have a property that's worth £500,000 and you have an existing mortgage of £490,000 and you try and borrow more against that, the bank's going to say no. You know, we'll get onto 99% mortgages in a minute, but you know, you've not got a lot of equity there in the value of that asset. If you've got a house worth £500,000 and you've got a £100,000 mortgage on it, then it's much more likely that they're going to lend you some extra money if you want it. And that's the same for a company. Again, imagine Tesco, the company, if they were worth, I don't know what the market cap is, let's say it's $100 billion. I think that's probably way overshooting it, but anyway, whatever. You know, let's say that the market cap of a company is $100 billion and their existing debt is, you know, like $10 billion, then a bank or a lender is going to be pretty comfortable that there's a lot of value there that they could secure against. You know, it's going to be pretty easy for a company like that to secure financing. If, on the other hand, you've got a company that's debted up to the eyeballs and there's not a lot of equity value left in there, it's going to be really hard for them to borrow money to expand or, you know, do some research and development and things like that. So the more a company is worth, the more financial flexibility it has. So that's number one. Number two is that it gives them, it's positive press, right? And, you know, we've seen, we see this a lot in the US market. You know, stock price movement is edutainment these days. You know, there are, you know, huge number of media publications that cover the daily stock tickers. And, you know, when you're talking about a price that is rising over a consistent period of time, that's positive press around, well, the products and services that company makes must be really good. And that becomes a natural kind of feedback loop on itself. So that's another one. And then the third one, and this is particularly relevant for growth stage companies, but really it's kind of, it can be relevant to any company really, and that is that the financial performance, the stock market performance, is how the senior leaders are that's the KPI that they're managed against. As you are, if you're a CEO, if you're a CFO, if you're, you know, anyone in the C-suite really, your primary objective is to grow the value for shareholders. That is your key responsibility. So if you're able to drive significant increases in a stock price, then that is your job done. And that kind of flows all the way through an organization. So if you have a CEO who's providing a lot of value back to shareholders, you know, he's going to arrange the KPIs for everybody underneath him and so on and so on and so on, based on the actions and based on what drives more value for. You have this situation where you have these incentives that are built into a rising stock price, and so that means that companies that are doing the best in increasing their stock price over a consistent period of time are going to be able to attract better talent, because you're going to get, you know, CEOs who think they can really hit some big targets and get massive bonuses. You're going to have you're going to have employees who are keen or who see stock compensation as a really valuable component. So that means you can attract really good talent to roles, you know, all the way down through to engineering and sales and all that sort of thing. So it's just basically this feedback loop where a rising stock price, it doesn't immediately impact the bottom line of a company. It won't necessarily change the dividend that a company gives in a given year, but it creates a positive environment and a positive sort of broad financial picture for companies to, you know, to improve their, you know, to improve and grow over the long time. So going all the way around the houses to sort of come back to the point that the problem that you have is that the US, or the problem that we have, I should say, in the UK, is that the US has become such an attractive place for companies to be and to grow and to list because of all of those factors. So if you're an owner of a company and you're considering listing a stock in the UK or compared to the US, then most in a lot of times, you know, the US is a bit of a no-brainer. You're probably going to achieve bigger multiples. You're going to achieve bigger stock price. You're going to be able to, you know, access a wider level of funding arrangements. And so we almost have this kind of brain drain of companies, you know, even big UK companies, I've seen this with Australian companies as well, are going to list in the US. And so it doesn't matter from an investment standpoint because we can invest in US companies, but where I think a big piece of the puzzle is missed and where I think potentially things like this British ISA can help is that it can, if we can get more more interest and more make the UK market a more attractive place to list and to invest, is that it's has the potential to make a really big impact on the economy. Because when you've got all these companies listing in America, what then happens is the headquarters are in America. And what then happens is that all the people that they hire in America and all those high salaries that they pay to like engineers and people like that, the majority of those are going to be in America. And so you have this brain drain and this push of, you know, all the best talent, all the best money flow going to the US. And so that's I've gone kind of, I think I've taken a bit long to explain that, but sort of that is why I think incentives like the British ISA are something that we should all think about from the long term. Because when we're investing in British companies, when we're investing in our own country, that does more than just look at our potential returns. And you know, we have to kind of weigh this off because this is a weigh this up because this is a real classic kind of short term versus long term sort of situation. You know, in the short term, you know, often you're likely to be able to access better returns in the US market than you will in the UK, at least in sort of the last few years. But longer term, you know, if we invest in the UK more, it makes the UK stock market, you know, improves our returns, but that then makes it a more attractive place for companies to consider listing. And it really does have this kind of spiral effect. So that's why I think, you know, if you have a way where you can invest, you know, get some additional incentives to investing in the UK, I think that's a really good thing. In Australia, the way they do it is called imputation credits or franking credits. And so the difference there is that if you have dividends that you receive from stocks, if you receive them from US stocks, for example, then you pay tax on the dividends, just, you know, as you would expect. Whereas if you have dividends from Australian companies, you're allowed to offset the tax that the company has already paid, which is interesting. So, you know, to use an example, if you received £1,000, dollars, if you received $1,000 in dividends from a US company, you would pay tax on $1,000. If you received $1,000 from an Australian company in dividend and the company had paid 20% tax already on that and your marginal tax rate was 30%, then you would only have to pay an additional 10%. So you would pay the difference. So effectively what that means is the $1,000 dividend from the US company would net out at $700 because you've had to pay 30% tax, whereas the $1,000 dividend from the Australian company would net out at $900 because you've only had to pay the 10% difference there. So that's another, and that's a reason why in Australia they invest very heavily into Australian stocks, even though the Australian market is really, really tiny, far, far smaller than the UK. So I think that's useful. I think that's just worth sort of having a little bit more of a broader context around. And when we're talking about investments, I think there's going to be a lot of stuff going around about, especially leading up to the election, there's going to be different options on the table and different potential policies. And I think keeping that kind of broader view of what investments mean for me now, but for me, what kind of world do we want to live in 10 years? And I don't know about you guys, but I want to live in a world where there's a bit more incentive for, you know, some real growth and some real competitiveness from the UK economy. Because at the end of the day, that is what's going to improve salaries. Like salaries in the UK have gone to absolute shit. And in the US, they are significantly better. And that's because there is so much more demand for talent in general. So the other thing I wanted to talk about today is there's been a new 99% mortgage, which has been announced by, I think it was Yorkshire Building Society. So they've come out and said that you can have a property for up to £500,000 with a £5,000 deposit. No product fee, so you'd pay conveyancing and things like that. But, you know, probably for less than 10 grand, you could get yourself into a property worth 500,000. The rate is a little bit higher than others on the market, but it's like, I think I said 5.99. So it's not, you know, it's not ridiculous. It's definitely higher than some of the rates you can get out there. But this is an interesting one. I think there's been a lot of negative talk around it, and how, you know, it's a risk and that sort of thing. My perspective is that really it's not a risk. I think this is actually a really good option for certain people, but it comes down to the same thing. As long as it's the right thing for you, and as long as you're following what I consider to be best practices when it comes to buying a home, right? So from my point of view, a home is one of the best investments you can make. It provides you with an avenue to eventually not have to pay for housing, even if that takes your entire working life. It will mean, as long as you make those repayments, that at some point in your life you will have a place that you own that you don't need to pay a monthly amount to live in, other than the you know, repairs and all that sort of stuff. But you know, I think that's a really good thing when you think about retirement planning. One of the best things you can do is have a property that you don't have to, you know, continue to pay for. So you know, I think that is should be an objective for everybody. And there's all the non-monetary benefits around that, right? So you don't have, you know, you can really lay down roots in a place. You don't have to feel transitory. You know, you can get your kids in a school and not necessarily be worried that you're going to have to move because you get priced out of the area. That sort of sense of security and stability that it can provide you, I think is well worth it. And this is a way for more people to get into that situation, which I think is a great thing. But of course, there's some things you need to be aware of. There are some risks when you're borrowing this amount of money, and you know, the key one really is just that level of equity is really insignificant. You know, when you're talking about an asset that's worth $500,000, you're putting down 1% of that. You know, that can, a property could lose 8, 9, 10% value in a year easily, really. So if you are looking at really kind of extending yourself in terms of the amount you're going to be borrowing against a property, you know, you really do have to be confident that this is a decision for the long term, because the risk is negative equity. So, you know, you buy the property for 500, you put down that 5,000 as a deposit. In a year's time or 2 years' time, the property's dropped in value. It's now worth, you know, 475,000, and you still owe 490,000 or something. And that's a problem, because that means you can't move. You know, you can, if you wanted to sell the property, you would sell the property and then you'd still have debt at the end of it. And that is not a good situation. That's not a position you want to be in. So, you know, it just comes down to really understanding what your long-term objectives are, what your long-term financial plan is, looking at the affordability of that mortgage. So yes, the rate, the one from Yorkshire is fixed for 5 years, which I think is quite good, because at least you're, you know, it is higher than normal, and rates are probably going down more likely than up. So actually that will get relatively more expensive over time. So, but you don't have the risk of that, you know, rate spiking above that and all of a sudden you can't afford it. So, you know, understanding the full affordability of that repayment, understanding what you're going to do at the end of the 5 year period. So, you know, what is the balance going to be based on the repayments? You know, what is the likelihood that you'll be able to refinance? What's your plan B if you're not able to refinance? And just really understanding kind of the totality of that decision. Yeah, broadly speaking, I don't think there's anything wrong with taking out a large percentage, as long as it's affordable to you. And as always, really prudent to make sure you're still maintaining an emergency fund. You know, if £5,000 plus, you know, an extra couple grand for different fees and things is going to literally wipe you out, then that's when you should probably think, let's just sit on this for a little bit and get some more funds together. Because, you know, when you own the property yourself, it is you on the hook for any problems that come up. These mortgages, this one in particular, is not available on like new builds, for example. So there's not going to be any warranty or, you know, anything like that on that. So, you know, the last thing you want is to absolutely scrape the bottom of the barrel to get into a home, and then you move in and the boiler dies, or, you know, you get a massive a hole in the roof or something like that. So, you know, again, it's just about being prudent and sensible. And as long as you've thought through all the potential outcomes, especially the potential negative ones, and you have a long-term plan, then, you know, I think having more options for buyers out there is a good thing. So I'm sure there's going to be people who disagree with me there. So if you do disagree with me, you know, please do drop a comment if you're watching this on YouTube, or feel free to send me your thoughts at my at jason@jasonmountford.com. But look, that's the episode for this week, guys. Been interesting kind of talking through these things with you. Is something I've missed with doing these shows is that it helps me kind of often helps me kind of clarify my own thoughts about different things as I'm thinking about them before the show, and then as I'm talking through them with you. So always would love to hear from you. So as I say, email is jason@jasonmountford.com. Drop me a question, say hello, tell me I'm shit. Like I'm not fussy. I just want to hear what you guys have to say. And if you do have time to drop me a review on Apple or on Spotify, that would be really greatly appreciated. Thanks again so much for your time, guys. And I shall speak to you next week.